Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, Houghton, Michigan, and the UP in general, not really known for its Muslim population, but that's starting to change.
I think it's, I feel responsibility that we have to give more information for people about the true Islamic religion and Muslims.
But first, Michigan's Schools of Choice program is 20 years old. In some parts of the state, the competition for students can be intense. Public school districts put up yard signs, much like political yard signs. Families are offered gifts to sign up for a school out of district. And the number of publicly funded but privately run charter schools has increased in recent years, adding to that competition. Earlier this year, the Holland Sentinel looked at the impacts on local districts in that area. Holland Public Schools have been hit especially hard. Joining us is the superintendent of Holland Schools, Brian Davis. Let's take this chronologically. When Schools of Choice was implemented back in the 1996-97 school year, you were working at a district which benefited, Zeeland. Why were students drawn there?
I think there are a number of factors as to why students were drawn specifically to Zeeland Public Schools. First of all, Zeeland was and continues to be a high-quality school district. They have a strong academic program. They have a rich offering of extracurricular activities. Specifically at that time, I was working as a middle school counselor, and so I often would be an individual who would provide additional opportunities for tours for families who were perhaps looking at school of choice options. What I saw happening at that time, a growing number of families who had concerns regarding the academic performance of specific students or specific populations in Holland Public Schools. And I think part of that happened as Holland became more ethnically diverse.
In the Holland Sentinel piece, you indicated you found stereotype-fueled assumptions about race were behind some of the losses to Holland. What evidence do you have for that?
The piece that was fueled by that was asking about the demographic makeup of schools. The way the media sometimes portrays or the way images are viewed or as we look at achievement results, students of color have not fared very well in terms of overall academic performance. And there's a whole host of reasons as to why that is. And a lot of times there's a significant intersection with students who live in poverty. If we look at all the research that's been done across our country with respect to the impact of poverty, when we look at the earning wages of African Americans and Hispanics, in many ways it's significantly less than their white counterparts. So I think a combination of all these factors contributed to that. What is documented in the research literature is white flight out of urban city centers. At that time as well, there was civil unrest in the city, and what I mean by that is there was a growing concern of the gang-related activities that were occurring in the central core city. So I think there was a safety piece that was added to that. Unfortunately, at the time, many of the individuals involved in the gangs were members of the Latino community. Then you get these race-based stereotypes that can be broadly put across all individuals, and then people look at, okay, academic performance, how are different subgroups performing? If that population is growing, is the academic standards or achievement levels going to be impacted for my own child?
What percentage of kids living in the Holland Schools District left for other schools?
We've lost, since I've been in the district in 2000, about 40% of our enrollment.
40%. Wow.
It certainly has a significant impact on resource allocation because those students don't always leave all in the same year. They don't always leave from the same building. They don't always leave from the same classrooms. As a school district, every 3 years, we were having to close buildings and realign our grade level infrastructures. That creates a real financial hardship for the district because you aren't able to necessarily reduce teachers over on this side of the district because you have just enough kids that you have to have the extras there, and then it creates a resource gap on the other side of your district.
I want to make sure I understand this. As diversity increases in a school district, some of the wealthier families leave, often white. Poor students, often people of color, are left behind. They don't have the same access to resources at home, and then the test scores at the schools drop. That makes the schools even less attractive. That sounds like a heck of a downward spiral.
The research would indicate that's what happens. I actually did my doctoral dissertation on an impact of school choice and how that impacted Holland Public Schools specifically. And across the United States and even in other countries, when you have the school of choice options in place, individuals look for culture, they look for school safety as part of that, they look for curriculum and academic offerings. And what can happen in urban centers is as a district becomes more ethnically diverse, you actually, as what's documented in the literature, will have and can have a white flight out of the school district. That leaves a less ethnically diverse school district. Now it's more homogeneous. It's just made up of a majority, in our case, Latino students, and a growing number of African Americans, a growing number of students. We have students from 40 different countries now. That can be a rich, very positive experience. But what can happen, though, too, is when you combine the economic factor. For example, 3 out of my 4 K-7 schools that I have now have students where over 80% qualify for free or reduced lunch. When you put that impact of economics on top of that, those that had the resources left the district. If they had the second automobile, if one of the parents didn't have to work a second job, I now have the resources to leave. Those that don't have the resources to leave tend to be, not always, we want to be careful to overgeneralize, those who don't have those extra resources. What can then happen is a second wave of school of choice that will leave the district, and that can actually be your families of color. Families will look at higher rates of free and reduced lunch equated with higher problems of behavior. Unfortunately, the stereotype is racialized from the standpoint of as your district becomes more ethnically diverse, there are those that question the academic achievement levels because some of our subgroups and demographics across the country have been underperforming in the way in which schools are measured in comparison to their white counterparts.
I want to clarify one thing, though. We're not talking about traditional white flight. People aren't leaving Holland necessarily. They're just taking their kids out of the school district. Is that correct?
There are a number of families who actually live in the school district and who take their kids to another school district that's right next door to us.
So what happens to...
Or actually live in our school district and attend one of the 2 charter schools who are right within the school district.
What happens to a community when you have schools closing, you have a lot of kids from the same neighborhood scattered around schools in the region? I mean, what happens to that sense of community?
It impacts sense of community very significantly. I was talking with a colleague of mine who's also superintendent, and even in his neighborhood, he shared that there are about 10 homes and families, and they all send their kids to different schools. What does that mean in terms of parent interaction at the school and involvement in PTO? What does that mean with my kids participating in the same musical this evening? What does that mean for my students playing on the same little league baseball team with their kids at school? What does that mean for my child, you know, at night going outside and playing with the neighborhood kids? I think the unfortunate piece about school choice, and I'm not against school choice, but I think that the whole notion that this was going to bolster the academic achievement and success for all kids, the research is pretty clear that didn't happen. I don't think anyone took time to pause back and say, from a social side, how is this actually negatively impacting neighborhoods and communities? And my research found that it's significantly impacting, where if I don't have the resources to go and send my child somewhere else, I'm actually frowned upon or even may be accused of being a bad parent. You have different resource allocation. I have many families who would love to be able to volunteer in their child's classroom and work and do, but if they're working 2 jobs, just to be able to have a place to live, provide for their children, and food on the table, I can't volunteer. Well, if all my volunteers have now relocated to another school, that impacts what happens in that school community and the relationships that are developed and so on. And so it really becomes a real challenge for schools that have seen that exodus. As the economic base shifts, as the individuals are able to volunteer and engage shifts, it really can have a negative impact on community as a whole.
Proponents of schools of choice program argue, though, that this would increase competition among schools. The better schools would attract more students and be rewarded with more state dollars. Didn't anybody foresee these unintended consequences? It seems like if you are aware of human nature, this was bound to happen.
I would have hoped people would have seen that, and I guess I would ask if that was the original impetus behind school choice for Michigan in the first place. I don't know if that was the original piece or not. Has Holland Public Schools gotten better because of school choice? Absolutely. Have we done things just because a charter school did? No, we didn't. We've kept true to our mission and vision, and we've had to readjust that all along the way. There are things that we started in Holland Public that some of the charter schools ended up doing after we did. I think it's helped the entire system grow, but here's the problem. We also had an economic recession during this school of choice period of time, and we've had hundreds of thousands of students leave the state of Michigan. But we increased the number of school districts in Michigan by adding the number of charter schools. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying there's an unintended consequence with that because now we have larger infrastructure. So as I am demolishing and taking down schools in the same city, we're building a new school for the charter school. That, to me, is not necessarily a good allocation of resources. The infrastructure, just in terms of traveling to and from schools in the morning, you have all these kids who otherwise could be walking to school or taking the provided district transportation to get to school, who are now in all these private automobiles driving to their different areas for their school of choice. There's added cost for that. There's added infrastructure for that. There's added impact on roads and gasoline. There's impact on buildings. There's impact on administration. So as we talk about a shortage to help support our schools in our state from a funding standpoint, we've created more infrastructure to support, which further exacerbates the problem. In a district whose declining enrollment like Holland is, that exacerbates our problem even more. So we have to respond and be able to say, how do we maintain and stay true to our vision? How do we provide supports to a growing number of families who find themselves living in poverty and recognizing that there are going to need to be additional resources that are needed to help get their kids to where we need them to be?
Brian Davis is the superintendent of Holland Public Schools. Thanks very much for talking with us about this.
You're welcome.
Coming up, as the NFL's regular season begins to wrap up, we dispel some misconceptions out there about concussions.
One of the biggest things we deal with in our clinic every single day are people that have been treated as if they're concussed when they actually have post-concussion syndrome, and the treatment is different.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Islamophobia has been rampant in the dark corners of the internet for a long time, and as close as Dearborn. Armed demonstrators have stood outside mosques and libraries in Dearborn protesting radical Islam, in quotes, or they were simply anti-Muslim. But there's a small enclave of Muslims in the Upper Peninsula who've not been ostracized. Dr. Osama Abdulkhalik is a faculty member in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Michigan Tech University in Houghton. He's also an advisor for the Muslim Student Association there, and he joins us now via Skype. Doctor, when you made the decision to move to Houghton, a small town in a remote area that's very white and very Christian, what were your expectations?
I was first attracted to Michigan Tech as a school and a good place to work. And when I asked about the Muslim community, I was told that there are very few Muslims in the area over there. So it was a little, from that perspective, it was a little hazy picture. But when I moved there, I found that the people there are very nice and open for diverse. So it turned out to be very well after all.
How long have you lived there now?
9 years.
9 years. So that's some time to really get to know the community. How's that been? I mean, are you active with people throughout the community?
Yeah, more or less. I'm trying to, within the Muslim community, yes, I'm very active with them, engaged with them in the activities that we do. And also outside the Muslim community, in the overall in the town, we have especially recently we have had some mutual meetings with other communities in the area, just so to get people to know more about the Islamic religion in general and the Muslims who live in the area. I think I feel responsibility that we have to give more information for people about the true Islamic religion and Muslims.
Do you think it's more accepting because it's a college town?
Definitely. It's a college town, and by default, there is a wide range of diverse students in town. And so the people there are, they understand this. They understand diversity.
Two of your children are teenagers, and they've mostly grown up in Houghton. Your oldest daughter decided to wear hijab. Teenagers can be pretty rough on anyone who's even a little bit different. What kinds of concerns did you have about how your daughter might be treated at school?
That's a very good point. When my daughter decided to wear hijab, she made that decision on her own. And I remember that when at that time I have told her and that she might face some let's say, troubles because of that, especially when it comes to friends and getting along with friends and colleagues. But she decided to do it, and I was amazed by the response from her friends. She never had a problem with that, and I can tell she had very good relations with her friends. They come for sleepover, and she visits all of them at their homes. So I'm really happy with that, which I can tell that's not the case probably in other places.
As we mentioned, you're an advisor to the Muslim Student Association at Michigan Tech. How have your students found their experiences? Have they seen the same kind of reception that you've received in Houghton?
I can say yes, because I have never, I can't remember that I have ever heard about a problem from or a complaint from one of the Muslim students. My answer is yes.
I understand you meet at a community center now. Are there plans to ever build a mosque in Houghton?
We would like to do that. And we have had a few meetings as a community. And we asked about the process for that. And we started the process. We know it's a long way to go. Mainly because we are a small community. But we started the process.
Diversity is valued at most higher ed institutions. I'm wondering how Michigan Tech reacted or, for that matter, marketed the fact that there's a small Muslim community there.
I can tell that Michigan Tech emphasizes highly on diversity, and they market their they have a lot of efforts in the diversity. And there is a diversity office, and there is a manager for that office and the group who work in that office, but I can't remember that they specifically talked about the Muslim community. They do a very good job in terms of diversity among all of the different religions and different ethnics. Nothing specific about Muslims that I can tell, but I can also say that whenever the Muslim student leaders go to school asking for help or advice, they have found what they always look for.
Dr. Osama Abdulkhalik, he's a faculty member at Michigan Tech University in Houghton and an advisor to the Muslim Student Association there. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In recent years, you've probably heard a lot more about contact sports and concussions. There's enough concern that a fair number of parents are deciding against letting their kids play rough sports because of the fear of concussions, and that might lead to permanent neurological damage. It's a complete swing away from the attitudes of the past of just walk it off. There's this new book which suggests that, yes, concussions are very serious, but there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about them. The book is called Back in the Game: Why Concussion Doesn't Have to End Your Athletic Career. The authors are Dr. Jeffrey Kutcher, a sports neurologist who went through the University of Michigan Neurology Residency Program, and Joanne Gerstner, who is the sports journalist in residence at Michigan State University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So before we get too far into this discussion, why was this book needed?
Well, it was needed, frankly, because I've been doing this for over a decade, and I began taking care of patients back when nobody cared. And it was hard to get people to understand this is a serious issue, not just concussions, but long-term brain health. With awareness, and we have great awareness now, and I think we're in a much better place than we were 10 years ago when I started doing this. But with awareness became oversimplification of messages and really sort of agenda-driven discussions, which have ended up causing more harm to my patients in the long run. So this book is really an evolution. It captures the conversations I've been having with my patients for over a decade.
This sounds like a contrarian view, and I thought, wow, that's a really good topic to sell a lot of books if you're, you know, kind of going against the grain. Is this just a contrarian view to the popular media coverage and the perceptions of the public, or is there something more than that?
Well, I think there's something definitely more to it. I came about this in a different way in that I was a Knight Wallace Fellow here at the University of Michigan. So I immersed myself in concussions in all facets. I heard from the patients. I heard from the parents of patients. I read the coverage. I read the journals. And I realized that what I was hearing as a journalist and then covering as a journalist did not match up what I was seeing. Taking a contrarian view was not something that we did just to say, aha, we're going to go left when everyone's going right. It's really that we needed to get back to talking about the truth, what we know medically and scientifically based, and also parse a lot of the mythology that's now springing up around concussions.
Facts are such sticky things. We now think of concussion as a traumatic brain injury, and I suppose it is. But you write that its symptoms generally are not as long-lasting if it's treated properly and quickly. So define concussion for us as we should understand it.
Sure. One of the big misunderstandings now, the word concussion is used to describe a lot of different things and not just concussion itself. A concussion is a transient injury. It does resolve. There are other things that can happen in addition to concussion. Post-concussion syndrome, for example, one of the biggest things we deal with in our clinic every single day are people that have been treated as if they're concussed when they actually have post-concussion syndrome, and the treatment is different. And people will never get better if they are treated as if they're concussed sort of forever. And then the third thing that concussion is often misused for are the long-term effects from repetitive brain injury. And that really is the big issue. I want my patients to get through their athletic career with their brain intact. And that's not a concussion problem. That's a repetitive hit problem. As a matter of fact, the movie Concussion was not about concussion, right? It was about chronic traumatic encephalopathy and the long-term effects of playing sports. That's a good example of how the term is misused.
You noticed a difference between definite concussion and probable concussion. Can you explain those differences and what that means?
Yeah, absolutely, because concussion is a diagnosis we make as physicians. It's a clinical diagnosis based on history and examination. There is not a confirmatory test. Every time we make a diagnosis, whether we actually describe it or not, in our minds we are assigning a degree of certainty. This is a definite concussion, a probable or a possible. We've written about this. This is a published schema. This is not just me making this up. The idea is really quite simple. If there is no other possible explanation for how the patient is feeling or how they're presenting to you in clinic, no other explanation at all, and there's a clear mechanism, that's a definite concussion. That's actually more rare than people think. When you look at how people play sports, symptoms they may have before the game, during the game, after the game, other things going on in their lives, there's usually something else on the list that could be possible. If those things are not as possible as concussion, then the concussion becomes a probable concussion. If you have things that are more possible than concussion, then it's a possible concussion. So that's not just a semantic sort of gymnastics. It really becomes helpful when you're looking at somebody's overall history of concussion, how many they've been diagnosed with, what are we actually talking about going on in these individuals?
Let's talk about being out on the field. Joanne, a parent's first instinct is to give the kid aspirin or Tylenol or ibuprofen to relieve the headache that they might get. The book notes that there are better choices than others when you come to do that. And I was really surprised about that. And then when I got to thinking about what ibuprofen does versus what Tylenol does, for example. So can you guys explain that to us? First of all, let's just clear it up. What don't you give your kid after a possible concussion to get rid of the headache?
Well, the first thing you're concerned about is something more than a concussion, specifically a bleeding event inside of the skull. If that's present, you do not want to give somebody a medication that's going to interfere with the clotting cascade. So anything that interferes with platelets, the things that float around in our blood and help form clots. So ibuprofen or Motrin, Aleve or Naproxen, those types of medications can do that. Tylenol does not. My preference would be, if somebody's diagnosed with concussion, is really to avoid giving the medications for about 24 hours because you do want to see what's unfolding in front of you. At that point, the risk of there being a bleeding event is very, very small, if not minimal, close to zero, and using a medication like that can actually be beneficial for the patient.
Why is quick treatment of a concussion really necessary?
Well, for a few reasons. Number one, you want to pull anyone off the field or practice facility that you think could have a concussion. Now, first of all, that is state law, and it's kind of the cliche of when in doubt, sit it out. So number one, you don't want someone participating in something if you think they might have a concussion. Number two, that then hopefully gets that athlete into the process of being checked out by, at best, having a certified athletic trainer there, or if it's just a parent or a coach saying, hey, how do you feel? What's going on? And allowing the athlete of any age to be honest, like, I don't feel that great, or I feel strange. And you have to remember that a concussed athlete might not be aware they're hurt. So it's kind of on the person who's in charge of kind of determining, they don't seem right. I need to get them proper medical care. So diagnosing it quickly is great because you don't want to leave someone in there to get more hits and to get further injured.
So when we say quickly, I mean, do you say sit on the bench or do we just say, hey, you need to go to the doctor right now?
Well, it depends because you got to remember concussion symptoms do not manifest immediately. So it's not like, wow, you broke your bone. There it is. Concussion symptoms can manifest over a couple of hours. So someone might get a hit and say, hey, you don't look right or whatever. Come sit down. Oh, no, coach. I'm fine. Put me back in. you can't take them at their word. You have to say, you know what, we're keeping you out. We're going to evaluate you and see how it is. Now, obviously, if someone has lost consciousness or there's some event that you can clearly say this is not right, then you get them immediate care.
So your book basically is encouraging people to not overreact and just drop out of sports. And we'll get to some of that. But when I hear sports professionals and repeated concussions leading to neurological damage, why wouldn't I worry about my kid on the soccer field or playing football being damaged for life? I mean, isn't it safer just to keep them off the field?
Well, so is it safer to keep them off the field? Certainly, but it's also safer not to drive them to the field in the first place. Our lives have risks, and we derive benefits from a lot of activities, and sports is definitely one of them. What we are advocating for is critical thought and a complete picture of what is actually the risk. It would surprise a lot of people to hear that the majority of NFL players who played 5 years or more in the league don't have a problem. That gets lost in the conversation. All we hear about are the bad cases. I've been taking care of former professional athletes for a long time. I've seen many, many hundreds of them. The vast majority are doing just fine, but you don't hear that. And then you want to put that in perspective for, well, that's professional athletes. What about my kid who wants to play up through high school football? It's a different level of exposure altogether. So we do want to take these things seriously, but we don't want to be handcuffed by a lack of information and a lack of critical thought.
I want you to both jump in here. A good part of the book talks about the loss of sports in someone's life and what kind of impacts that might have on their well-being, that quitting because of a concussion can, in some cases, lead to people experiencing depression, even consider suicide. And I don't mean to be over-dramatic, but it kind of leaves you with the perception of, oh, great, I've got to choose between neurological damage to my kid or the possibility of losing that kid to suicide. Sort that out for us.
Well, it's think about it this way. The things that we participate in as children, whether it be band or drama or playing on the tennis team, those all give us critical parts of our being. It's a tribe. It's who we belong to. It's our friends. It gives us status within our communities and our schools. And so if you say, don't do this, I'm taking this away from you because you probably shouldn't be playing anymore, or I'm afraid of you playing, we're actually kind of saying, you know what? Don't do that anymore, and then don't worry about it. But then you don't see your friends. You don't have the social status. You don't have the physical outlet to go out there and maybe burn off some of that energy that you're not going to get in other places. And I just know, you know, for being a female that grew up playing sports, that was a really critical part of my development of leadership skills, learning how to win and lose. And I'm not saying you can't get that from the chess team or forensics or other things, but for me, that part of my development helped me as an adult. So when you kind of weigh this whole, should I do this or not do that, that's a huge thing that you might be missing out on.
So you've experienced professionals who've actually dealt with depression after they lost or had to leave their sport. Tell me about how that works in this whole explanation.
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely critical that we understand the complexity here. I mean, I'll start with a simple study that was published about 3 years ago in 2013 or so that looked at former NFL players that played from the 60s to the 80s. These played more than 5 years, so they're fully vested pension players. The suicide rate in that population until 2008 was less than half of the general population. Think about that for a moment. Football players, NFL players played in the 60s to the 80s when they were knocked out in the first quarter, played in the second quarter. That population had less than half the suicide rate of the general population until 2008. What happened in 2008 is we started talking about it. The messages started to become oversimplified. People started worrying about, am I going to commit suicide? I'm depressed. And there is a known concept called the suicide contagion that is very well described, that if you oversimplify suicide, if you don't, if you're not careful about the messaging, that you can actually promote suicide in that population. So I see that in my clinic, whether it's a professional athlete, a former college athlete, or even a current high school kid who's playing and his parents are concerned. They come to me and their chief complaint is, I don't want to commit suicide. You ask them, well, have you ever thought about it? And they're like, well, no. Well, then why are you thinking about it? Because I saw Junior Seau on ESPN. That's the conversation we need to be having. You know, what are we really doing out there? And let's face it, I mean, coming down from any career, whether it's a radio journalist or a physician or a professional athlete, there's transition in that. You magnify that hundredfold by putting that in a young person at age 30, 32, who was a star, who's, you know, a known entity and has this whole persona around what they do, take that away from them like that. That becomes an issue that really just drives that whole process.
So what's the bottom line here? What do you want athletes or parents of athletes to learn from the book?
mainly it, get good information and don't make assumptions. We really have a void right now of critical thought and a comprehensive approach. So seek out answers from people who can put everything in perspective for you, all sides of the equation.
That's Jeffrey Kutcher and Joanne Gerstner. They wrote the book, Back in the Game, Why Concussion Doesn't Have to End Your Athletic Career. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan Radio is involved with several news media partners and a project called the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. One of the issues we're looking at this year is justice, things such as mass incarceration and wrongful conviction. There's a nationwide network of legal clinics that are working to litigate the claims of actual innocence by prisoners. Many of these clinics are basing their work on DNA evidence, which has led to clearing the names and releasing hundreds of people. At the University of Michigan, the Michigan Innocence Clinic operates a little differently. It pursues cases where DNA evidence is not available. Joining me now is co-founder of that clinic, David Moran. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So I want to take a big, giant step back for a moment. After several civil disturbances across the nation back in the 1960s, including the Detroit uprising of 1967, President Lyndon Johnson appointed a commission to take on the causes of these disturbances and look at the remedies. It was called the Kerner Commission, and among the findings were grievances about the discriminatory administration of justice. The findings included a statement that, quote, a presumption of guilt attaches whenever a policeman testifies against a Negro, end quote. What has been done in the nearly five decades to remedy that grievance?
Well, there have been some improvements nationally. I think it's undeniable that, for example, African Americans are better represented in police forces, especially urban police forces, than they used to be. They're also better represented in prosecutors' offices. So if there's racism in the charging decision, maybe there's an African American member of the prosecutor's office who can help alleviate that. And there's also more African American lawyers, defense lawyers who are sensitive to the issues of race, and more African American judges. So the system has gotten more diverse. There are more members of minorities, including Latinos, Asian Americans, than there used to be. But obviously, we still have a long way to go.
On the Innocence Project website, about two-thirds of the people exonerated nationwide were African Americans. African Americans make up about one-third, a little more than one-third, of the inmates in state and federal prisons. Black people make up less than 13% of the population. What can you infer from those numbers?
Well, what those numbers show is that African Americans are more likely to be wrongfully convicted than white people are. Now, I should say the Innocence Project's data is a little bit skewed from what we see because they do DNA cases and DNA cases only.
Right.
And DNA cases are overwhelmingly sexual assaults. In sexual assault cases, when there's a wrongful conviction, it's usually because there was a bad eyewitness identification. And one of the leading causes of bad eyewitness identifications is cross-racial. So if you have a white or Hispanic victim identifying an African-American rapist, there's a better chance of a misidentification than if you had people within the same race identifying each other.
Why is that?
Well, the studies have consistently shown that people are much better at facial recognition of strangers of their own race than people of different races. So I think the DNA cases, and there's now over 300 of those exonerations since 1990, show that black people are more likely to be wrongfully convicted, which is true for the non-DNA exonerations, the kind of cases we handle in the Michigan Innocence Clinic as well. I don't think the numbers are quite as stark. There is something called the National Registry of Exonerations, which keeps track of DNA and non-DNA exonerations going back more than 25 years. And there were close to 2,000 of those registered exonerations, including 66, I think is the latest number, in Michigan. And again, there's a disparity. There are more African Americans, DNA and non-DNA, on the National Registry than the percentage of the inmate population nationally. But it's not quite as stark as the DNA numbers.
And again, the percentage in prison is twice that right. of the population, 13% versus 37%. One of the things that I read on the Michigan Innocence Clinic website is that there are a number of causes. You just mentioned one of them, but government misconduct was also another. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. I should make it clear that I do believe, and the statistics bear out, that even in cases without DNA, in other words, even in non-rape cases, African Americans are more likely to be wrongfully convicted than white Americans. But there are a number of other causes besides eyewitness misidentification that are especially prevalent in the non-DNA cases, including prosecutorial and police misconduct is a leading cause of wrongful convictions. And typically what we're talking about here is failure to turn over exculpatory evidence. So an investigation is done, evidence is gathered, but some of the evidence doesn't point to the person who's ultimately arrested and convicted, and that evidence doesn't make its way to the defense counsel, so it's not used at trial.
What would be the motivation to do that?
Well, I think in the vast majority of cases, it's unintentional. I don't believe in the vast majority of cases that the police or prosecutor set out to frame someone. I think what happens is they see a piece of evidence. It doesn't fit with their preconceived notion as to who did it. They've got a suspect. They develop tunnel vision. And then they get a piece of evidence that doesn't fit. And so they think, well, that's useless. That's wrong. And so they don't think of it as important to turn it over. When the defense lawyer sees that same piece of evidence, the defense lawyer says, oh, my God, that's a piece of evidence pointing away from my client. And I'll give you a really good example if you have a minute.
Yes, please.
From Lansing. This is not one of our cases. This happened about 10 years ago. There was a fellow named Claude McCollum who was convicted of murdering a Lansing Community College professor named Carolyn Cronenberg. And Ms. Cronenberg was found dead in her classroom at Lansing Community College. Her students showed up to take the class, and they discovered the professor was dead. She'd been murdered. And there was only a fairly narrow window in which this murder could have occurred because the classroom had been used for an earlier class. The Lansing police immediately focused on Claude McCollum, who was a homeless, mentally ill man who often spent time on the Lansing Community College campus. They interrogated him. They extracted what they called a confession, which was basically a rambling statement of, maybe I could imagine committing this murder, and they convicted him. And it turned out, all this time, there was a video from the Lansing Community College library showing that during the window during which Ms. Cronenberg was murdered, Mr. McCollum was asleep on a chair in the library. And that evidence wasn't turned over to the defense until it was discovered more than a year after Claude McCollum's confession. And the prosecutor and the police officer who didn't turn it over thought that the timestamp on the video had to be wrong. Therefore, this really wasn't exculpatory evidence. And how did they know the timestamp was wrong? Well, it had to be wrong because Claude McCollum confessed in their view. Well, it turned out that while Claude McCollum was sitting in prison, there was a man named Matthew Macon who was committing other murders in the Lansing area, and he was eventually caught. He was never formally charged for this murder, but it's widely believed that Mr. Macon was the real killer. So the tunnel vision here sent the wrong man to prison, left the real killer out on the streets where he committed more crimes, likely real killer, out on the streets where he committed more crimes during the interim. But I think it's a good example. I don't believe that the prosecutor thought he was framing an innocent man. He just thought he had a piece of information that wasn't real helpful to his case and wasn't useful. I should say that prosecutor, assistant prosecutor, was fired.
False confessions is something you bring up here, and that has been shown to happen a lot more than we ever would believe. People just can't imagine admitting to a murder that they didn't convict, but we've seen it because of some recent programs on cable TV or Netflix that show cases where there were false confessions. Are we coming to a new understanding about whether false confessions are more common than we thought?
Yes, definitely. 25% of the DNA exonerations have been false confession cases. And we're seeing
25%?
25%. About 75 of the more than 300 DNA exonerations. And we're seeing similar statistics for the non-DNA exonerations, including in my clinic. We've had several exonerations in my clinic where people falsely confessed. So this is a sort of police misconduct we see where they make promises. They say, sign the statement and you can go home. And the statement contains a false confession. Sometimes people are tricked into signing statements that they didn't actually make. You know, I wrote up what you said. Just sign here. Trust me, this is what you said. And it's not really what they said. Other times they're interrogated for hours and hours, and they're told, you're not going home until you tell me what I want. And people think, well, finally, I can't take this anymore. I need to go home, and I can clear this up later because I know I'm innocent. And there's plenty of evidence that will show that. So false confessions are a real problem. The system is starting to catch on. In Michigan, a few years ago, Governor Snyder signed a bill requiring that interrogations be videoed, at least in serious cases, and that's progress. So we can see, for example, when the police are feeding the suspect facts that he or she didn't otherwise know. We can see when coercive tactics are being used. We can see if the person's under the influence of something that might make their confession unreliable. But it's not enough. What we really need to have happen, and we're getting a growing movement for, is to change the way the police do interrogations in the first place, to follow the model that has been adopted, particularly in the United Kingdom. It's called the peace model. And there, instead of an adversary interrogation in which the police come in, as they've been trained to do in the United States for decades, which is, we know you did it. We're not going to listen to your denials. We're going to tell you over and over again you did it, and we're going to stay here until you tell me how you did it. Instead of doing that, police in Britain have been trained to an open-ended sort of interrogation where they basically say, just tell me what happened, and then pin the person down on the details. And if the person is lying, then the details are going to fall apart upon further inspection. So instead of doing a confrontational adversarial interrogation where the officer does almost all the talking, the peace method is have the suspect do all the talking. And if the suspect is guilty, if the suspect is lying, he or she is likely going to hang themselves.
We can't cover all of them because there are lots of different reasons for wrongful convictions, but I want to touch on one more. Bad lawyering is another contributor. What are the reasons behind that? I know Michigan has been looking at indigent defense rules, but are we seeing the kinds of changes we need to make sure that somebody who's poor and can't afford a lawyer and gets an appointed one is actually getting the kind of representation they should?
We're moving in the right direction, but we're nowhere near there yet. Michigan has one of the nation's worst systems for providing lawyers for poor defendants. So this is one of the reasons why I believe we see a strong disparity racially between who gets convicted and who doesn't. So the poorest counties and counties that have high minority populations in Michigan, we have a system in Michigan where it's county by county. There's no statewide system for indigent defense at all. So it depends on which county that you happen to be arrested in as to what kind of defense you're going to get. Well, the poorest counties have the fewest resources to provide adequate defense, and those are counties where you have a lot of minorities. So it's no surprise that about half of our caseload in the Michigan Innocence Clinic comes from Wayne County. It's Detroit, where they have no public defender office to speak of. They have instead a system of appointing private lawyers and paying them very little. And the way that cost structure works is that you simply can't do a good job and make a good living if your living is based on taking these appointments to do indigent defense. And so we've seen some of the same lawyers over and over again in our case who will take hundreds of cases and do basically no work on any of them. They have no time to do an investigation. They're not going to hire experts. They're not going to hire a private investigator. They're not going to talk to the witnesses. Because if they did that sort of work on any of the cases, well, then the whole thing would fall apart. They wouldn't have time to do any of the others. It's basically a plea mill, where they try and convince the clients that they should take the first plea offer that comes around, get the case off their docket, get paid, go on to the next case. It's a real problem. Now, we're starting to see progress in Michigan. The governor has signed a bill that created the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission, which is tasked with the job of coming up with a series of recommendations to the legislature and to the Michigan Supreme Court to improve indigent defense in the state. The problem is that the law creating the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission specifically says that they have to retain the county-by-county system. There can't be any statewide system. Michigan is one of only a small handful of states that does not have any kind of statewide system of public indigent defense.
If that's your preface from the beginning, it's a little self-defeating to have some kind of meaningful reform, though, isn't it?
Unfortunately, it is. So the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission seems to be getting off to a great start. They're proposing requirements, but what can't happen under the current system is a statewide system of public defense, which is really what Michigan needs.
Between what we've seen with the Innocence Project and with your clinic, what kind of conclusions have you come to about wrongful convictions and race?
Well, I think it's undeniable, the statistics prove it, that if you are African American or Latino, you are more likely to be wrongfully convicted of a crime than if you are white. And it's typically not a case that the police picked up a person of the wrong race. That's not the issue. The issue is that they picked up a person who was the correct race in most of these cases, but the system failed and the system was not as responsive as it would have been in the wealthier counties, the wealthier suburbs, to what was going wrong. The urban centers process so many cases, they don't really have time to think about how to try this case adequately, how to make sure this person is getting the measure of justice. If you go to Detroit, if you go to Wayne County Circuit Court, and this has been written about for decades, there's a real concern with case processing. We want to move cases as quickly as possible. Well, that maybe works great for the person who's guilty and wants to get a great plea deal because the system wants to move the case as quickly as possible so he or she can maybe extract a pretty good deal from the prosecutor. But if you happen to be innocent, it's a really raw deal because all the pressure is on you to plead. All the pressure is for your case to go away as quickly as possible because we've got hundreds more coming in the door, and it's really hard to get a fair shake. And so it's simply a matter of resources. In my view, it's not a coincidence that the under-resourced courts, the under-resourced counties are the ones that have high minority populations.
David Moran is a law professor at the University of Michigan and co-founder of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Lester.
New Year's Eve is almost here. Time for a little warm-up at bat. Here's a cocktail.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
So Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings is here. And we usually bring you a cocktail at this time, but you've been talking about different spirits in Michigan. Lots of distilleries these days.
Right, and we've used rum and gin and whiskey that's been made right here in Michigan. But there are some spirits that are tied to a particular region of the world and that we can't make here in Michigan.
Right, you think wines like Bordeaux or Champagne, but there are spirits too.
Right, so tequila has to be made in Mexico. So there aren't any Michigan tequilas, but today I'm going to take you to Lopez Tire Repair in Detroit for a tequila with a Michigan connection.
Let's go.
So we're here at a tire shop in Detroit. How do you get from there to tequila?
Well, my father was raised around the agave fields back in his hometown in Arandas, in the ranch called Las Cruces.
We should mention that we're talking with Antonio Lopez, who's talking about his father, Silverio. The family is making and bringing in Cabresto tequila.
He originally thought of calling it Tequila Silvestre or Silverio, like his name, but it was already taken. So he came up with Cabresto. Cabresto means a horse's bridle.
So tell us about how this tequila is made.
Our tequila is made with our blood, sweat, and tears. My dad goes down to Mexico every 2 or 3 months, goes tends to his babies, his agave plants. He gets down and dirty with the actual humidors. All that loving he puts into it comes out to these great piñas. And once he harvests it, he takes it to the distillery where they go through the laborious process of fermenting it, cooking it, and ultimately distilling it and aging it.
Where can people get this?
Like I tell everybody, we're not in a whole lot of shelves, but if anybody wants to try it out, ask for it at your local liquor store. That would actually help us put it on the shelf.
So we've got a Detroit family who owns land in Mexico, growing the agave, and they're distilling it and bringing it to Michigan and trying to make a go of it here. So we always make a cocktail. Can you make a tequila cocktail for us?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that I really liked about the Extra Añejo tequila that we tried is that even though it's been aged for 7 years, it still has a lot of great tequila flavor. Sometimes when you get those older tequilas that have been aged like a whiskey, they kind of just taste like a whiskey. It's all wood. This still has a lot of that agave flavor. So I wanted to use it in a cocktail that would really show that off.
And what cocktail is that?
I'm using it in the old-fashioned cocktail.
So old-fashioned, that's usually a whiskey cocktail.
These days, yes. But while we call all sorts of different things cocktails today, historically, cocktail meant a very specific thing, and that was just a spirit with bitters and sugar. And so it could be any spirit at all. Whiskey's the most common these days, but it's a great way to show off an aged, older tequila.
What's in it? How do you make it?
Old fashioned is one of the easiest drinks to make. Put the ice right in the glass that I'm going to drink it in, a rocks glass or an old fashioned. Put a little bit of simple syrup. I used 1/2 ounce. You can adjust the sweetness to your tastes. A couple dashes of Angostura bitters, and then just a couple ounces of the tequila. Gave it a good stir, squeezed an orange twist on top to give some nice bright aroma when I sip it, and then you're done.
All right, well, let me give it a taste and see what we have here. Wow, well, it tastes like an old-fashioned, but it's got that tequila right up front. You can really taste it.
That's right. It's a really good avenue for something that is really meant to be a sipping spirit on its own. So we didn't do a whole lot to it. We just kept it simple.
Well, that was a fun trip. I learned a lot. I hope we can do it again.
I hope so, too. Cheers.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.